and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, polar explorer Lonnie Dupree. Over the past 25 years, Lonnie has traveled over 15,000 miles throughout the high Arctic and polar regions by dog team, ski, and kayak. In this month, Lonnie will make his second solo attempt to reach the summit of Denali in the month of January. Recorded days before he left for Talkeetna, Lonnie talked about preparing for Denali in past expeditions at REI in Anchorage on December 16th.
My name's Lonnie Dupree, from Grand Marais, Minnesota, and I used to live in Alaska. I lived in Alaska from 83 to 1986, commercial fishing in Bristol Bay, and that's actually where I got my first love of the Arctic, is Bristol Bay area, and did a lot of running around a little village out there called Pilot Point, and so spent a lot of time out there, and Just got hooked on the Arctic. And then in the winter of 1985, a friend of mine went up, John Peterson and I went up to Brooks Range by Bettles, and we snowshoed around the southern reaches of the Brooks Range for several months in the winter, just to explore that area. And so completely hooked on the Arctic. That's where I kind of got my whole, just the whole love of the Arctic is started from Alaska. I'm going to go through some slides, and I'm going to show you some video, and then I'll answer any questions you might have at the end of the program. I'm going to start with this here. This was one of the first major expeditions I was on with a friend of mine, Paul Shirky from Ely, Minnesota. And it was supposed to be a joint expedition between the Soviet Union and the United States. There'd be six Soviets, six Russians. And what we'd attempt to do is travel 1,000 miles by dog team from Anadyr, Siberia, all the way across this part of Siberia, across the Bering Sea to Big and Little Diomede Island, and then down and around to Nome, Alaska. Again, it was just promote peace between the two superpowers. We would do it by dogs. It was during a time of Gorbachev, when Gorbachev was in office, and so there was a lot of cooperation between the two countries. And what was interesting about that expedition, not only were we promoting friendship between the two countries, it also allowed the Inuit people that were part of the Bering Bridge expedition team on the U.S. side to meet with their relatives on the Siberian side. So this is Darlene Apungaluk from the village of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, meeting her three aunts that lived in Siberia for the first time in 50 years, because 50 years we've been separated from that country where no travel has gone on. So Darlene speaks Yupik, and she could talk with her three aunts fluently, which is pretty cool. I ran into this when we were dog sledding from one town to the next, ran into this Chukchi reindeer herder, and they use these little dog teams and these little fast sleds for rounding up the reindeer out there in the tundra. But what was most unique about this guy's outfit here was his sled. His sled was made out of reindeer antler. So you can imagine very, very super strong stanchions, or uprights there, stanchions, and then he just put some driftwood on here, a couple of places there, and he threw a caribou hide on the top, and he's got some rope here, probably made from seal skin, and he'd round them caribou. Those dogs are really super fast. And after that expedition in 1989, from 1991-92, we made a 3,500-mile journey by dog team, just two of us, myself and a fellow Alaskan, Malcolm Vance, where we left from Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, in October of 1991, and we traveled all the way through the Northwest Passage and down to Hudson Bay, just over 3,000 miles away, reaching that in April of 92. And we traveled to 13 Inuit villages along the way. Just to understand a little bit more back then about the Inuit culture, but also how life has changed for the Inuit people over the years. And also, and just to find out how much of the culture was intact from Alaska all the way over to the east. And so we lived and stayed with a lot of Inuit families, and it was really fun because at first we didn't know what to expect when we got in these communities, but traveling as far as we did by dog team, I always got respect from people, and they always take us under their wing and teach us the tricks of the trade and staying warm and eating good food and just learning a little bit about seal skin, about how to keep your kamiks dry. Always had us over for tea and cookies, and that was always fun. And then after that expedition was over, in 1995, my then wife Kelly Dupree and I crossed Banks Island in Northwest Territories, because you can kind of see where Banks Island is up there. Mackenzie River Delta is in here. It's an island that's about 250 miles across. At that time, it was home to 75,000 muskox. So there wasn't a single day that went by that we were not we seen muskox no matter where we turned. And the biggest hardship there was just trying to keep our dogs from chasing them over the hills with all our luggage our luggage on their back. And so we traveled with backpacks, and our dogs had backpacks as well. We could put about 30 pounds of gear on the dogs' backs. And we traveled an average of 15 miles a day. And it was a really interesting way to travel because I've always, for all the years prior to this, always traveled with our sled dogs in the winter. So it was very nice to be able to utilize them in the summer as well. This muskox was killed by a pack of polar wolves on the island. And the dogs, of course, as soon as they get to kill like that, they like to roll in it with all our gear on their back. And after that expedition, I went on to launch an expedition to circumnavigate Greenland. Greenland's a big place. They call it an island, but I think they should call it a continent, especially when you're trying to get around it all non-motorized. It's 6,500 miles all the way around. We kayaked the southern part, 3,000 some odd miles here. And then we dog sledded 3,000 plus miles around the top, plus a lot of dog sledding in this area here. Greenland's 1,700 miles long, 350 miles wide on average. The ice cap in the center is about a mile and a half thick. If all that ice was to melt, it would rise the ocean levels 18 feet. It's a big, big place. You can put 14 Englands inside of Greenland. Yet there's only 40,000 people that live in Greenland, mainly on the west coast here. Small communities, small villages. This whole coastline, with the exception of a couple villages here, is completely uninhabited. Some of the most dangerous areas of kayaking in the world are right here. And then, of course, dog sledding up in the far reaches of Greenland is quite dangerous as well. So we started right here in Pamute in 1997. Started traveling by kayak up the west coast. And this is what a typical community on the west coast looks like. This is actually quite a very large community called Upernavik. But you can see all the icebergs dotted in the landscape there. I think this was taken in late August or so. But I like how all the houses are painted primary colors. It's just beautiful, especially when you're coming into a community that is in the winter when it's just snow, just white and rock, gray rock. It's nice having those colors. When John and I kayaked around Greenland, probably the most difficult part of the entire kayaking was the East Coast. We had a section of the East Coast of Greenland that was called the Blossaville Coast, and that's basically 750 miles of mountains sheer to the waterline. So there's very few places to camp on this. Matter of fact, there were times when John and I had to piton the boat up onto the rocks and sleep up with the birds on the ledges in our sleeping bags, on several occasions, matter of fact. But here we are just trying to wiggle around the coast. Sometimes it was best to go right next to shore. Sometimes it was better to be a mile or two out, depending on, you know, how the ice was working that day. And the typical beach, when we could find one, was pretty bouldery like that, so trying to get a nice flat spot for the tent was almost impossible. But gorgeous. I mean, this picture was taken end of August. Towards the end of the expedition, we spent all in all 5.5 years planning, funding, and getting around Greenland. Of that 5.5 years, 22 months were on the trail, broken up in 3 separate legs, some 8 and 6 month legs. A couple days before we actually finished the 6,500 mile circumnavigation, we ran into this little hut, a little hunting hut that they use in the out of Amasalik, Greenland. They use for hunting narwhal. But for to us, this was like the Ritz-Carlton, you know. We got in there, we were able to dry out stuff. We hung our little solar panel here to charge all our batteries and stuff for our phones and that kind of stuff. In north part of Greenland, we launched a lot of our expeditions out of a place called Kanak. It's the north, one of the northernmost Inuit communities in the world. This is home to 500 polar Inuit people, and they travel everywhere by dog teams. There's no ATVs, no snow machines, nothing like this. Everything is, all travel is done by dog team, or by boat, or by kayak. So we're launching our expedition here. We're loading up sleds. We use Inuit dogs. These are the same kind of dogs that Robert Perry used to discover the North Pole in 1909. These dogs have lived a feast and famine lifestyle for 5,000 years. They're really hardy animals. And this is our team here. We're rounding the northern part of Greenland, a place called Cape May in North Greenland. And we ran traditional fan hitch, and then we skied along our sleds. And we skied because just to take the weight off the sled a little bit, but also to just be able to stay warm and get some exercise. We could steer the sled from the back. And I'm just untangling dog lines. You're looking out into the Arctic Ocean from the coast of Greenland, northern coast of Greenland. So you can see how pressured that sea ice gets when it's pushed up against the coast of Canada and Greenland, and the kind of effort it would take to get a dog team through that, or skis and sleds and stuff like that, because you got from here to the North Pole is about 478 miles, something like that. Long, long ways. When John and I set up camp at night, we put dogs in batches of 5 or in different areas around the tent to act as polar bear alarm clocks, and John's just chipping some ice to melt for drinking water in the tent. And inside the tent is a very crowded, stinky environment. We got socks hanging from overhead. John's putting some ice in the teapot. And back then they didn't have the internet or GPS or anything like this. Fancy radios. I just had a single sideband Spilsbury SBX-11 radio that I could transmit up to 600 miles with to a base wherever the radio person was at that time, either in a village or further south in Greenland or what have you. And then I got this picture on the very northern edge of Greenland up by Cape Morris Jessup. I heard the dogs whining one night, and I thought, oh, there's a bear in camp. So I opened up the tent door and looked outside, and there were actually 4 polar wolves that were trying to kill the dogs, have the dogs for food. These are by far the most northern wolves. They're right on the very edge of the Arctic Ocean, on the northernmost extremity of land in Greenland. And this guy, when I first got out, this guy and Canute, my lead dog here, they were like touching noses almost. And very, very cunning, very mysterious animal. This is John and I flying the Geographic flag on the northernmost piece of real estate in Greenland with our lead dog, Canute. He couldn't see what all the fuss was about. Very cold day there. But our whole rounding of Greenland, probably the most prized part of rounding Greenland for me was just living and traveling and hunting and just being with the polar Inuit up in Kanak. Still dressed very traditional. They use a lot of times polar bear nanus or pants, and they usually have caribou kamiks, sealskin, kodita, anorak, trimmed with foxtail. After that expedition, I heard a lot from the Inuit elders in Greenland how the ice is getting thinner and we're losing a lot of ice up there, and they're really worried about what's going on down south. Why is all our ice melting, they were wondering. And so I went on to do an expedition to bring attention to climate change and what's going on with all the sea ice up in the Arctic. And so the route we're going to take is we're going to leave from Ellesmere Island and go to the North Pole, and we're going to conduct science along the way. And for not only NASA, but the Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. And we're going to do this in the summertime, starting in May, and hopefully getting to the North Pole sometime in July. Now this map here, this dotted line that you see here, is where sea ice, the extent of sea ice was in 1978. From 1978 to 2005, we've lost all this ice in the summertime. Now from 2005 to now, we have lost all this ice here. All this ice here is gone, and they predict, and 3,000 scientists around the world believe that in the next 8 years, we won't have any ice in the Arctic anymore. In 8 years, because it multiplies. You get a little opening in the sea ice where it has that nice dark sea ice or seawater down below. That sun, instead of reflecting off the ice and going back to space, it hits that dark seawater and absorbs the energy from that sun and heats up the Arctic. So we started off from Ellesmere Island on May 1st of 2006. And how we're going to try to get to the North Pole in the summertime, because we're going to reach a lot, we're going to have lots of open water, is we need to be amphibious. We need to be able to go in and out of the water like a polar bear if we're expected to travel across this stuff. So we had sometimes we wore special dry suits. Sometimes we could just slip our canoe sleds in the water and paddle them across. And so what we did was we took 8 foot long whitewater canoes and made them into sleds, basically. So this is a typical sea ice. We had to wrestle across in there. Our boats started out about 250 pounds a piece. And so there were dog sled runner plastic on the bottom, UHMW. On the top, we had a Cordura zippered cover. And we only got 400 more miles to go. But as we work our way north, the ice gets less and less pressured against the coast, right? So as a further out you get away from the coast, that the ice is more loose. And so you get a lot more open water between the ice flows. And we still got to be able to navigate those. So when you get up high, we'll get up on a big chunk of ice and we'll look up and we'll kind of see, okay, we got to kind of wiggle through there and wiggle around there and jump over that. And it's just trying to connect all these puzzle pieces in order to be able to wiggle through that ice. Sometimes we just use them as little blocks to jump across like that. And then we would just drag the boats across. We don't have to worry about the boats, or the boats even loaded with 250 pounds, they're not gonna sink. And then after 2 months, 60 days, we made it to the North Pole on July 1st of 2006. We were a very skinny couple of guys there, and happy it was over because it was quite a haul getting there. When we were at the North Pole, we were sleeping in the tent, relaxing or trying to relax for the very first time, and we had this bear come up to the tent, and he just... We had lots of scary bear encounters prior to this, but this one, this guy, he just came up and he walked around the tent, basically on the snow flaps, just circled the tent a couple times and then took off, this particular bear. So then after that expedition in 2009, that last one was 2006, 2009 I decided to do a winter expedition to the North Pole to commemorate Robert Perry, who went to the North Pole in 1909. So in 2009, I got a team together of three. Behind me, Max Chaya, Stuart Smith, to the right of the screen there. We would try to leave Ellesmere Island on March 4th, the first day the sun comes above the horizon in the wintertime, and try to make it to the North Pole. Well, we loaded up in Resolute Bay, Canada, all our fuel and food that we're going to need for the expedition and fuel for the aircraft. And you can see the drums of fuel that are attached to the back of this. It's like it's old DC-3 tail dragger that Ken Borick Air had. And I took this shot because I'm sick. I got food poisoning that night. And here I am where I'm flying. It's 40 below zero out right now here, and I'm sick as a dog, and I can't believe I'm going another 400 or 500 miles north to start this trip. But we had a lot of money banked or shored up in all these flights, so I had to go. But I slowly got better as the day went on. We flew from Resolute Bay up to Eureka on Ellesmere Island and refueled and jumped into a different aircraft, where we then flew to the very northern edge of Canada. Edge of Ellesmere Island, this little place out here is called Cape Discovery. And this is where we would land on the backside of that, and we'd start off from that cape out into the Arctic Ocean on March 4th. We landed, we got out of the plane, it was minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit. It was so cold, in fact, that our bodies created an ice fog that filled the valley behind us. This is all ice fog created from our bodies. It was cold, and I tell you, there was no rest because you couldn't just stand even for a minute to rest because the cold would just creep right into you. So you resting was basically running around in circles, doing jumping jacks, trying to eat what frozen candy bar you could to get some energy, and then just start pulling again. And so our rest periods in the beginning lasted maximum of like 5 minutes. And then they got longer as it warmed up. You can see Ellesmere Island is in the far corner here. We're starting to make a little progress north. We found this frozen lead that was kind of flat and that headed north. So we jumped on that and started heading to the north. And but we had to keep our hands and our face well covered, because at those temperatures you develop frostbite quite quickly. Those early days just never warmed up. It was stayed in the for the first week in the minus 50s, and the second week in the minus 40s, and every now and then you get a 38 or 39 below zero, which felt pretty started to feel pretty balmy. And even in the tent was very, very cold. So here we are. This is like the first couple days in. It was a long, hard day. We get in the tent and we started the stove. This is my stove system for polar expeditions. It's a double whisper light MSRs put together back to back, so you can boil large amounts of water, get plenty of heat off there. But what had happened was MSR had switched the O-rings in their stove pump assembly, so when it got really super cold like that, they shrunk and leaked gas everywhere. So what I had to do is I told the guys, jump in your sleeping bag, grab a candy bar, take a pull of hot chocolate off the thermos, and I'll let you know when I get the stoves ready. So they crawled in their bags, and I grabbed the pump out of each one of those fuel cans, And then I climbed in my sleeping bag and I stuck one of the pumps under my armpit, and the other one I tried to get, I took a match and I kind of heated it up a little bit and I stuck that under my armpit. The other one, I heated that one up. And 3 hours later, I finally got the stoves going. And so at minus 58 degrees below zero, if you try to handle these fuel bottles with bare hands, your skin will just stick right to those fuel bottles and you'll peel skin right off your hands. It's so cold. So so you always have to handle these bottles with gloves on. Matter of fact, it's so cold you get it in a tent, there's just a few degrees change where it might be warmer in the tent. Those bottles are just smoking. They're so cold. Working our way through the pack ice, you can see, you can get up a little ways, as hot, far as the eye can see, it's rough. And it's very hard mentally when you get up and look, and it's just like, oh, I can't believe we got to pull the sled through that. But you know what? It always seems to get better. There always seems to be a route through this stuff. And the trick is just being able to pick those routes. And having traveled enough on the Arctic Ocean, I was able to, you know, wiggle us through the easier spots, and we kept making steady progress. When we pull our sleds, we have metal edge backcountry skis that are fully skinned. And those skins are glued on to the bottoms of the skis and screwed through the P-TEX. Those skins never come off the skis, and that's what we use to pull the sleds. We use the sun and the prevailing winds for navigation. Once in a while, a compass if the sun's not out. But the only time we use our GPS is when we actually get into the tent to figure out our position and how far we travel that day. And then we'll turn it again on, the GPS on again in the morning to see how far our camp has drifted overnight, because that sea ice is constantly moving. We might turn on that GPS and find out that we drifted 6 miles overnight. So then we have to readjust our navigation for the next day. Our face has got always frosted up, our eyelashes got really frosted up, so we usually just took the palm of our warm hands and got rid of the frost on our eyelashes and stuff. And then there are some beautiful times too where you got two big ice floes come together and they pop up a big block of ice like this, big blue block of ice. It was always nice to know that the ice was 8 feet thick under your skis. It's not like you're going to punch through into the water. Spent a lot of time when we got the cracks in the sea ice where we had to, you know, try to find our way around, and 99% of the time we could always find a way around these cracks. When we got to newly formed sea ice, the freezing of that sea ice, especially when it was cold, would create these frost flowers that would form on top of the ice. Beautiful, quite beautiful, but very sticky to ski on because it's pretty salty. We had special made skis in Norway that were good stiff skis where we could span cracks like this and you'd be pretty safe. You wouldn't have to worry about them busting. And one particular day we were making a crossing like that and Stuart put his foot through the ice. And it was quite cold that day, maybe minus 40 or so. And he put his foot through and he skied on his wet boot all day. And then he kind of forgot about his toes a little bit. And by the time we got to the camp, he says, "Yeah, Lonnie, I think I might have froze some toes here. Take a look." And sure enough, he froze his toes really, really well. So we spent the next, he still had 300 miles to go to get to the North Pole. So every other day I'd bandage his toes up and take the old bandages off and clip dead skin away with my Swiss Army knife and put some more tape on. And by the time we made it up to the North Pole, I think his toes were a little thinner than they were when he started. So we would do 15 of those type of crossings every day. At first you're kind of antsy about it, but then you start trusting in your skis and how to use the ice to your advantage to get across those spots. When the areas were too thin to support us on skis, we would do the rock, paper, scissors thing, and one of us would have put the dry suit on, and we'd skimmy across these thin areas like a little, you know, like polar bears do when they don't want to get wet. They just spread out their weight, and we wiggle across. And we usually tie a line to our waist, and when we get to the other side, we pull the rest of the team across in sleds. We just catamaran all the sleds together. And then at the end of each day, we whatever pictures we may have taken or what have you, and how what we would do is download those pictures from a digital camera into a Palm Pilot, and that Palm Pilot we connect to a satellite phone, and we'd send that stuff out back to our home base in Minnesota, and then they would post that stuff on the web. So now we're getting close to the pole, and we're doing some really super long days. We're getting tired because we're approaching the pole. We're hoping to approach the pole on the Siberian side of the pole because the sea ice drifts kind of from eastern Siberia across the pole and out towards the Greenland Sea. So when you're coming from Canada to the pole, you want to be able to get around the backside of the pole so you let the drift work in your favor. Well, because of a storm, because of a storm prior to getting to the pole, it pushed us to the downside stream of the North Pole. So the sea ice at the North Pole drifts at 4 miles a day to the south, from eastern part of Siberian side of the Arctic Ocean out through the Greenland Sea. So we got caught on this conveyor belt of ice that's dragging us south. So the first 4 miles every day was just to get to the zero mark, you know, and then we had to start the day. So after 2 months, we reached the North Pole. Yeah, that was, we reached it, March, May, sometime in May there. And we each lost about, Stuart and I lost about 30 to 31 pounds, and Max lost about 20 pounds, and Stuart and I lost about 30 pounds apiece. But it was a long, hard, that was a long, hard slog, but it's that kind of expedition that has honed me for what I'm going to be attempting to do on Denali in a few days, to climb Denali in January. I was up there last year and made it up to 17,000 feet, only to get stuck there due to high winds up above 17,000 feet where you can't, there's no way you can move in that weather. It was just too dangerous. So I just stayed my cave up at 17,000 feet on Denali, waiting for good weather to come. But so this is the kind of expeditions that prepared me for the cold wind and sometimes darkness that you're going to experience on the mountain. So anyways, after that gives you a little idea of the two North Pole expeditions, both leaving from Cape Discovery to the North Pole. The red one being the summer, the blue one being in the winter. And when we did that last winter expedition, it was to commemorate Robert Perry and Matthew Ensign, who went to the North Pole in 1909. This is Robert Perry's great-great-granddaughter, Tecumseh Perry, that lives in Greenland, northwest Greenland. And then this is Matthew Henson's great-great-grandson, Usakuk Henson, lives in Connacht, Greenland as well. So I go on to chat a little bit about climate change and what's going on about that. We're losing sea ice at an alarming rate. And some of the things that we need to think about, not just as the United States, but the world in general, is that we need to put some kind of carbon credit legislation, giving people credit that don't pollute and people that put in CO2 in the atmosphere, more taxes on those folks. The United States, which is 7% of the world's population, we create 26% of the world's greenhouse gases. We use 36% of the world's resources, only 7% of the world's population. So we tend to live a little bit more beyond our means. So I try to advocate for trying to live a little bit more simply with a little less stuff. Think before we buy, where did it come from, what's it made of, how's it impact the environment. Invest in clean, renewable energy. We got wind and sun out there, free energy. If we can invest in those kind of technologies, we're going to be putting people back to work. The big white elephant in the room, no one ever wants to talk about, population growth. There's, I think, 1 million new people on the planet each week. And eliminate a cutting rainforest, because rainforests, as you all know, they absorb CO2 that's in the atmosphere, which is great, and they produce oxygen we all need to breathe. And we lose 30 million acres a year to clear cutting, and when you cut a rainforest, it doesn't come back. And there's a lot of other benefits from rainforests too, like finding new cures for cancer or other diseases, things like that. So there's lots of benefits for keeping those rainforests around. And even though we may not have rainforests in Minnesota or in, you know, parts of Alaska, we still need to do whatever we can to help maybe Brazil not cut their rainforests. And if that means helping them preserve those by paying to keep those intact, it'll benefit everybody on the planet. And of course, better mass transportation. We have very poor transportation system in the U.S. We need more of this, because if we don't, we're going to all end up maybe like this polar bear trying to grab onto a little piece of habitat to stay alive. Because we only got one of these, and we're really good at taking and taking and taking, but not giving anything back to this little blue planet. Now I'm going to go into Denali. I'll run through this fairly quick, and then I'll answer any questions you might have. Before I decided to climb Denali in the winter in 2010, in 2011, we climbed it in 2010 in the summer, a group of us from Grand Marais, Minnesota. And we took some instruction from Alaska Mountaineering School in Talkeetna, and we've all have backgrounds in various outdoor activities and things like that. So a group of us got together and we figured, well, we're gonna get some training, and I'll take care of a lot of the winter camping stuff that we need to worry about, and we'll just do the best we can and see if we can make it up the mountain. If we can't, we'll just turn around. The four of us jumped in a Talkeetna air taxi plane and headed to the mountain, and there's Denali sticking through the clouds. There, heading our way, we're just about ready to run through one shot pass there. And then we landed at base camp and started working our way up the mountain. And here we are just above Squirrel Hill, looking at the west buttress, one of the west buttress ridges going off towards the west. And then climbing up on West Buttress Ridge towards 17,000 feet. Pretty steep here on both sides, you gotta be quite careful. Probably a half a mile drop on both sides. And then after 17,000 camp, we start working our way up to 18,000. Giving a little rest at 18,000, this is my friend Tom Supernot, who was my base camp manager last year for my winter attempt. Not real happy camper. We're a little dehydrated, very tired. And then at midnight, I think it was the end of May or June, I can't remember to this day, that we summited. Buck Benson, friend of mine from Grand Marais, Tom Supernot. And then I took this shot with the shadow of Denali behind me on the clouds. Very, very hard, difficult climb for us because we did it in 13 days. So this is as fast as you can climb Denali and climatize properly. And so pretty wrung out here. We had a hard day. That summit day was 19 hours. Buck and Tom were getting pretty played out, so we kept it pretty slow and just kept real cautious getting back down the Audubon, which is very dangerous, back down to 17,000 camp. And then we're out of there. So I I climbed that in the summer to see if that was something that I might be able to undertake in the winter. And I realized that after that it was something I could do. And so I went on to do as much training as I could and get as much experience as I could in certain mountaineering skills that I'll need specifically to the Denali West Buttress route. I didn't need to really know how to rock climb. I really didn't need to know how to ice climb too much. I just needed specific skills that I would need for the route. Because my background is polar expeditions, it's not mountaineering, but I needed to know specific techniques for that route. So I went to Colorado to train pretty hard doing that. And then after the training was over, the technical training, I went on to acclimatize prior to getting to the mountain. So I acclimatized to 18,500 feet, sleeping in a hyperbaric chamber and then also using this apparatus here while I did a workout, either pedaling a bike or up and down on a Stairmaster. It was awful, actually. I'd much rather go to Colorado and hang around some 14,000-foot peaks and do this. Which is what we did this year. I left that behind. As most of you know, that's the route that goes up Denali. Starting at base camp, which I'll fly to. I'm going to attempt to fly there on the 21st of December here in 4 or 5 days. And then work my way up the route. I'll use Paul Talkeetna Air Taxi. This is owner Paul Roderick. Loading up the Beaver, flying over the Cahilton, the glacier, and probably of the whole route, the whole expedition, the glacier probably scares me the most because there's a lot of hidden surprises, a lot of hidden crevices that it's almost impossible to avoid on that route. So I carry I use a 14-foot aluminum extension ladder where I cut out every other rung to make it light. Attach them together. I put my sled on one end and I ski off the end, the other end there. And the theory is that if I punch through a bridge, the ladder would hold me like a huge snowshoe, and I'd be able to somehow wiggle out of that and stuff. Because if you're traveling solo, if you go down one of those crevices, chances of getting out are very, very slim. So that's kind of how I travel with that system. But what I've done now is I modify this. I have a couple of hooks on the ladder and I actually ski at the very end of the ladder. So if I go through the ladder, the sled actually holds me back because it's a gradual uphill on the Cahilton. So the chances of the ladder and sled coming in with me are pretty slim. I marked the entire route with bamboo wands. Some of the wands have reflective tape on the top so I can catch those wands with my headlamp. I got 3M reflective tape up here. And then my wands for this year are all going to be black duct tape. Because when you have low light conditions when I'm out there this winter, these kind of colors just don't show up. You're better off having just black, straight black. There's a crevice bridge that opened up between the back of my skis and the front of my sled. I didn't even know it until I was stopping, taking a drink out of the thermos, and I turned around and there was a big hole in the ground. And I've been in for, 4 days, I'm just jamming my ski poles ahead like this. Matter of fact, by the time I got to the end of the Cahilton Glacier up at about 11,200 feet, my rotator cuffs hurt so bad from trying to find those holes in the snow, to avoid. I eat a pretty high calorie diet. One of the things that I've made for my North Pole trips that I use on this expedition for food is it's a bacon kind of pemmican. It's like partially cooked bacon. Food processed together with dry cranberries, and that's really good to eat. And then I have a lot of, the typical chocolate and some cheese and some nuts and things like that to get me through the day. I don't take a tent or tarps or anything. I just take a shovel and a snow saw, and I make all my snow trenches that I live in right with those two tools. And I usually cut a box about 3 feet, 3.5 by 3.5 feet by 3.5 feet deep. And then I cut those blocks out of there and I place it overhead like rafters. And then I dig out for my head and feet off both sides. And that's how I live in the cave. It's warmer, quieter, and you're much more secure. It's you know, it'll be 20 degrees in that snow trench versus, you know, 40 below zero outside in blowing wind. There's some snow blowing off of Denali on some smaller mountains here. I'm actually on the Kehiltna heading up, Kehiltna Glacier. In the cave, kind of wishing I would have built it a little bigger, dug it all a little bigger, but that's what I had. So tired, hitting the sack, and then back at it again the next day. And it takes me about 2 hours to dig a cave. So you always got to leave enough energy at the end of the day that you can actually dig a cave, because you're really tired. You're low on oxygen, you're tired, and it's dark, and now you got to spend 2 hours digging a cave. So I use every bit of available light, because it's this time of year to travel. So I get up several hours before light with using my headlamp, get everything ready, get the thermoses filled, all that stuff, get packed. And as soon as it's light enough and safe enough to travel, giving me enough light to be safe, I clamber out of that thing and I start heading up the mountain. And I'll go all the way until it's just dark. And then I'll stop, turn my headlamp on, and dig my trench. So if here's looking at the ceiling of one of my trenches where I have the camera just down between my legs, shooting up at the ceiling. Looks like a turtle shell. And then I'm just snug as a bug in there. And I got, I don't know if this little beep thing works here, but anyways, I got some stuff sacks that plug the hole of the entrance, my shovel, my ice axe. This is a little antenna for a transistor radio. I pick up radio in Anchorage. I got my spoon. And then I got a little seating platform that I'm sitting on right there. Now I'm up getting close to 14,000 feet. Some of the big crevices that are just behind me there, trying to avoid. And then after 14,000 feet, working my way up to the bottom of the headwall at 15,000. So after that, I made it up to the bottom of the headwall there, where I took a photograph from down below, from just over my head, looking at Hunter and Farker. Here I clipped in some supplies into the fixed line. There's a fixed line right there. You can see that, to dig out of the ice. Clipped that in, went back down to 14, slept overnight to acclimatize, and went back up to this location, and then back up the headwall. I think the headwall is about 1,900 to 1,000 feet of about a 45 degree pitch up to the West Buttress, actual main part of the West Buttress Ridge. And there's the West Buttress Ridge. I'm up on top of there's a very narrow section probably that runs 100 yards. I'm up on that section heading towards 17,000 feet. So going from 14,200 feet to 17,200 feet in one day is a big push. And I did the last part of the West Buttress in the dark. All I could see was my headlamp. A little circle that my headlamp made, which was probably good because I probably would have been scared otherwise. And finally made it to 17,000 camp. And I take a rope with me because on the way back down Denali, I would rappel the steepest sections of the route. So I'd tie in like up by Bradford, or up by Washburn's Thumb, because there's a steep section there that I would just rappel that down as far as I could. There's sections on up by Denali Pass that I would rappel in certain areas. So I took a rope for that. Very lightweight rope, it's just 7 mil. So from there I dug a snow cave and wanted to stay one full day and acclimatize to the altitude. Then I would go up the next day. Well, I woke up the next day and it was blowing really, really hard, so I couldn't go anywhere. So I just I spent some time in the snow cave just trying to get prepared for the next day, which was just as bad as the next day and the next day and the next day. So I ended up spending a week in this snow trench waiting for good weather that never came. So at the end of that, of course, you can only stay up for so long, and then you get kind of atrophied for being up so high and not moving too much, and also not have you can only carry so much food and supplies with you. So at this point, I couldn't wait any longer and had to come down. So I went from there all the way back down to base camp in about 4 days, I think it was, where I got picked up by Paul Roderick with Talkeetna and Air, and ended up back in Talkeetna over some really good food and a good beer. This was the best meal I ever ate in my life. It was a seared halibut and some fresh stir-fried vegetables and stuff like that, and a beer. It was really tasty. So that was the end of Denali. But I, you know, a few weeks after this, you know, you start forgetting about the hardships and a few things that you'd want to do different if you had another chance to go at it again. So as the weeks went by, things started clicking again, and I'm going to be at it again in another 4 or 5 days, if the weather permitting. And I felt I need about a 13 to 14 hour window of good weather to actually get up to the summit and back down. So I'm hoping I get that 14 hours this year. If I get to 17, if I'm lucky enough to get up to 17 again. So anyways, that project. And I've been working on a book for about 9.5, 10 years called Life on Ice, 25 Years of Polar Exploration. This is about all of my projects, starting with first living in Alaska in 83, and then talking about Banks Island, North Pole trips, and stuff like that. But you can order that book online and follow our next Denali trip online on my website, LonnieDupree.com. So please do that if you so desire. And anyways, I'll answer any questions you might have on any of those trips. Yes?
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with polar explorer Lonnie Dupree. He talked about past Arctic expeditions and preparing for his second solo attempt to summit Denali this January 2012 at an event hosted by REI in Anchorage on December 16th. We have a link to Lonnie's website where you can follow along on his Denali expedition at alaskapublic.org. Following his presentation, Lonnie responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, what do you use for bear protection in the North Pole?
On our North Pole trip, our first attempt in 2005, which I didn't show you this, where we left from a place in Siberia, we had to shoot a bear. And the bear was clearly a very old male that was clearly starving. It swam across the lead to get to our tent, and when he got out on the ice, you could just see the rib cage. All the hair was off of his face. And when you get old bears like that, they resort to cannibalism, you know, the females and the young. So this bear was clearly starving, and there was nothing we could do to keep that bear away from us. We used flares. We shot next to him with a handgun. All that stuff, and I don't think pepper spray would have stopped him. But I think pepper spray would stop majority of the bears, but a bear like that, it just he was so hungry, he just came right at us. So, yeah, there was nothing we do. But 90% of the bears, yeah, pepper spray. But what really was effective for us was pencil launchers. You know, where we had a little, it was a little flare, that little bright flare that went out and then exploded, made quite a concussion, quite a bang, and that would almost always scare the bear away, bears away. I don't know where you get them these days. They're just pencil flares. You screw a little rocket on there and fire it off. It's pretty, they're quite effective, actually. We just call them pencil flares, yes?
Assuming you have perfect conditions for your upcoming Denali trip, are you expecting to be out there for 18 to 21 days?
Yes. Okay. Yep, that would be ideal. But as you know, with the weather you guys have been having around here lately, 100 mile an hour winds in Anchorage, I don't think we're going to get an ideal year this year. But, you know, I'll hole up for a while, and then I'll just keep going again and be real careful ascending and just take my time and not worry about it, not get too worked up about it. And if the timing's right, I'll do it. If not, come back down. This is another day, you know. So, yeah. Any other? Yes.
What happens if the wind starts up when you're approaching the summit of Denali?
Yeah, there's a lot of mountaineers that get blown right off their feet. And actually, when I was coming around Windy Corner, which is at about 13,000 feet on Denali, I came around the corner and I could hear this whistling. It was calm. I could hear this whistling, and I thought, "Oh, that sounds like some wind coming." I was just getting down, starting to crouch down low, and the wind came, and just had me on one foot like this. And then I managed to get my ice axes in, huddled down tight to the ice. The wind blew over, and then I could get up and I could go another 50 yards, and then hunker down, and the wind would blow over. So it'd come in gusts that you could hear, at least around Windy Corner. But yeah, as you get up high, when I was at 17,000 feet, those big snow blocks that I cut from my roof, I could feel them going, wanting to lift off. And all these smaller blocks from around the snow trench blew away. But so as soon as I got a lull in this storm, I crawled out, cut a bunch more blocks with my snow saw, doubled up my roof layer with another layer of blocks, and it was okay then. But it can get pretty windy up there, yeah.
Once you commit,
yeah, that's the thing. Once you commit from 17, you're pretty committed, because the slope, there's two slopes you can take up to the 19,000 foot ridge. You can either go the Audubon up through Denali Pass, or you can double ice axe straight up from 17 to Zebra Rocks, which both come to the same place. It's just a shorter distance, but it's much steeper climb. Much steeper climb. So, you know, that's a 2,000 foot gain, double ice axing. This is a lot of work. So it just depends on what your skills are.
Will all of your weather forecasting be based solely on what you know?
Yeah, well, actually, I can call in and find out, but you know how weather forecasts are, especially when you're up that high. They don't really have a clue what's going on. So I just try to weigh out the weather reports around the mountain and prevailing winds and, you know, that kind of stuff, and then make a determination to go. Because when I go, I have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and be on the trail at 4 a.m. Climbing in the dark. Because I need to use any available light, which is going to be about 6 hours for my descent, because that's the most dangerous part of the trip. So most of my ascent from 17 will be in the dark. Gee, I want to thank you guys for coming here tonight, and thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with polar explorer Lonnie Dupree. He responded to questions from audience members following his talk about past Arctic expeditions and preparing for his second solo attempt to summit Denali this January 2012. We have a link where you can follow Lonnie's progress up Denali at alaskapublic.org. Lonnie Dupree was recorded at an event hosted by REI in Anchorage on December 16, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.